Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 18th of November. Professor Guy Alito is our guest this hour as we talk about China. He's an associate professor of history and East Asian languages and civilizations at the University of Chicago, teaches modern Chinese intellectual and social history, labor history, the Chinese Communist Movement. Most of his courses and all of his graduate courses are in the area of modern Chinese history. His interest in China began while he was a history student at King's College at Penn, where a professor suggested that he choose an area of specialization in which few American scholars were focused, places like India or China. He became impressed by the length and continuity of Chinese culture, studied Mandarin in Taiwan, and he went with all the early Chinese delegations to visit the United States after Nixon's 1972 visit to China. In addition to official conversations and professional briefings, the delegates were interested in how the typical Americans lived. And he says, as I was with them 24 hours a day, I became their major source of information about American life and society. In 1986, he opened the first site for rural research. In 2001, he was interpreter for the EP-3 recovery team that recovered the crash-landed U.S. surveillance aircraft from China. He is the author of The Last Confucian, Liang Shuming, and the Chinese Dilemma of Modernity, and he has become a regular commentator on the Chinese media. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Alito as we look at the president's visit to China. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Professor Alito, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Kathy.
You must have seen so many enormous changes since you first went to China and you were doing all the interpreting back in 1973. It has changed so much, hasn't it?
Oh, enormously. It's been a complete revolution. In fact, those places that we visited in 73 are hardly recognizable. I think of going to Shanghai, where things hadn't changed even slightly from the 1930s. It had the atmosphere of a small town. Mm. And now, of course, it is the most modern or modernistic of all urban enclaves in the world. It is becoming part of what will probably be the world's largest city, that is to say, the lower Yangtze Valley from Hangzhou to Shanghai, is becoming integrated into one great big, I guess you'd call it, urban sprawl. Hmm. So that's compared to 73. It's, as we say in Chinese, 天壤之别, the difference between heaven and earth.
Hmm. Well, I guess you picked the right country to study, didn't you?
Yes, apparently. Had many, many adventures, especially as interpreter for various delegations over the years that an ordinary American would never, never have. Having a picnic with Aaron Copland, having dinner with Lenny Bernstein, having cocktails with Arthur Miller, and so on. Because I was the interpreter for various Chinese delegations over the years.
Huh. I would imagine that's an incredibly difficult job. You're talking about diplomatic translation here, and by golly, you have to make sure you get everything right.
Oh, indeed, that's true. And I must admit that sometimes I was forced to interject, although you're not supposed to do that. I mean, interject some elements that originally weren't there so as to avoid culture clashes, I suppose you could put it. For instance, the Chinese in 1972 were, to say the least, extremely puritanical. And so the delegations coming here would be associating with various Americans, big shots. I mean, we saw everybody from the president on down it was an extremely interesting way to see the United States, looking only at the elites. But sometimes people would do such things as tell a dirty joke, which, of course, I couldn't interpret directly, because that would have meant a considerable, gap in...
Oh, that's funny.
In 73, one of the other few Americans who were traveling with us was Shirley MacLaine, the movie actress. And she hadn't been clued in on this. I talked to her interpreter. She had her own interpreter. And what was going on was essentially she would ask an embarrassing question like, how many times a week with your husband or something of that sort? And, of course, the interpreter would change it to something completely different so as to avoid both sides being embarrassed.
Oh, my goodness.
More than you know goes on. Of course, in formal diplomatic discourse, this is not a question. It is when everything is being recorded permanently. You know, those people you see sitting behind the Chinese leader, or the American leader, depending, with a notepad in their hands, they are extremely strict, because this is something that I remember. I was interviewed for a job because the United States had no high-level Chinese language interpreters during the 80s. During the 70s. In fact, they still don't. That is in the State Department. Vance, Secretary Vance, had visited China and found that the Chinese did all the interpreting. So he came back plenty mad about this. This followed Carter's disastrous speech-making in Warsaw, where they had hired casually an English-Polish interpreter who made a mess of things and embarrassed Carter considerably. So at that point, the State Department did cast around the country and invited about, I think there were five of us, to Washington. But because interpreting doesn't go anywhere in the State Department, consequently, they were offering this relatively bad deal. And I certainly wasn't ever considering it seriously. So interpreting is extremely rewarding in certain senses, and as I said, puts you into many adventurous situations. But you can't make a career of it.
So there are still, considering this may be one of the most important countries in the world and our relationship with that country is so crucial, there still aren't many high-level Chinese interpreters?
No, because they have to use State Department personnel. And the State Department, although it trains people in languages at the drop of the hat, I remember the political council from Canton who came down to Hainan Island during the plane fiasco, for instance, had been trained in four different languages, including Chinese and Hindi. But she really couldn't handle any of them very well, and it was not in her interest to do so, because if you become associated with a particular area and become proficient in that language, then there are certain anxieties about this event. It is not a good career move, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, it is often the case, including then the first part of the drama on Hainan Island in 2001, whereby the Chinese did all the interpreting again.
Hmm. Today's New York Times, I thought this was an important paragraph. Let me read it and get your response. With China's micromanagement of Mr. Obama's appearances in the country, the trip did more to showcase China's ability to push back against outside pressure than it did to advance the main issues on Mr. Obama's agenda.
Well, this is perfectly true, but no one really expected any deliveries on this trip. It was primarily pomp and circumstance. The expectations basically on both sides were not all that high, at least among the insiders, among the governments themselves. The public is another matter. And, of course, that's the way that China manages high-level foreign visitors. I remember... this was back in 72 when Nixon visited China. He went to a performance in Beijing. He and his party went to a performance in Beijing. I found out later that the entire audience of the theater was rehearsed, not once, but twice before that event. So in the same way, when he had that event in Shanghai, I think it was Shanghai.
Yes.
Yeah. That was certainly closely managed. There's no no chance of any kind of untoward developments. Well, of course, when he went to the I don't know if you've ever been to China.
Yes, and, I have. 84.
Oh, that's pretty early.
Mm-hmm.
And Badaling, the place on the Great Wall where he went. The entire area, which usually has, God knows, tens of thousands of people all over it all day, was closed off, entirely closed off for him, for his visit. It reminds me, his house is about three blocks from ours here in Hyde Park. And when he's back here and he hits the Lakeshore Drive, every exit is, of course, closed. So he goes down Lakeshore Drive with not a nary a car in sight.
Is it okay to still live there for you?
Oh, sure. They aren't
fun.
Back, or he isn't back that much anymore. So it makes very little difference when he is or when someone in the family is back. Then, of course, we start seeing police barriers almost outside our front door, which is all to be expected, of course.
And what do the Chinese, because you live three blocks from President Obama, they expect that you have a special take on him? They come
Yes, they do. I've been interviewed on, for instance, Inauguration Day. I was interviewed by Chinese, the major kind of net news service on Obama, because apparently, since I'm his neighbor and all, I should know best about him.
Why is it that a lot of the news that came to our country was the lack of news coverage of the president's visit in China, the censorship of the press? Can you tell me a little bit more about that, Professor Alito, and why they wouldn't show his speech to the students in Shanghai?
Well, they err on the side of caution in any of these public events involving foreign leaders. Obama actually got his personality was showed through, unlike many others. The reaction to him, the way he handled himself, his oratorical abilities, and so on in public, was regarded as extremely good, genuine, human, impressive by the general public. So the last time the Chinese public had such a reaction to an American president was with Reagan, who was also greatly admired for being genuine and a good communicator and so on. So he actually got more play than I suppose some others might have gotten. The Chinese state likes to keep things under control.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's a far cry from the old days of the Cultural Revolution period or even before that. And there is no attempt anymore to be literally totalitarian. But certain traditions live on. And one of them has to do with a very central Chinese concept of faith. That is, you cannot allow something embarrassing to show. A concrete example, 1974, Antonioni, the Italian director, visited China, and he just took some footage along the way of a few villages. But these villages had not been approved, had not been, as the Chinese say, prepared. And therefore, a major criticism campaign was launched against him because he showed something of China that wasn't prepared for international consumption, I suppose you could say.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this hour, we're talking about China and the president's visit to China. We will talk about, well, you can't talk about China without looking at how they have weathered the financial crisis, and reports are they've done that in relatively good form. I'm interested in hearing why that is from Professor Alito and what they could do to help us with our economy, if anything, and what talks took place along those lines while the president was visiting with the president of China. Well, we welcome your phone calls as well. We have an extremely interesting guest who has been at the forefront of the opening of China to us. Remember, it wasn't that long ago. We had no clue what was going on in that country. I still wonder if we have much of a clue because I think it's an incredibly secretive place, but it's certainly more open than it was. And he's been involved as a student and scholar of this country and also as an interpreter, so he has a deep understanding of all the communication going on back and forth. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address, if you'd like to send one of those, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program this Wednesday, Hunger in America. We go to phone calls now for Professor Guy Alito, starting with Doug from Eau Claire. Hi, Doug.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I'd like to have the professor give his opinion about our current unequal footing that it appeared to be from Obama's visit that he came away with very little of the issues that he was addressing. And I think it's becoming more apparent to most Americans that we have given away a lot of our strength over the years from basically the American business greed of wanting to tap the Chinese market and giving technological expertise away for the manufacturing of that those products and concessions that we did with the Japanese back in the 80s. Only now the Chinese have taken that as a strength, and of course most people realize that we owe so much money to the Chinese for their supporting our treasury bonds, and I'm just wondering if we don't look a little foolish in from our own past hubris and arrogant attitudes, and maybe we should learn from the Chinese that since they have perfected the art of patience and strategic, they have a strategic strength in looking at the long view.
Professor Alito.
Yes. Well, the thing that we have to learn from the Chinese, in the long run, there's no solution to our relationship without it, is to produce more, consume less, and save more. That, in the end, is what this unequal relationship that you're talking about consists of. When Deng Xiaoping visited the United States in 1979, I remember very clearly that in his public reaction to the visit, we're going to have regular diplomatic relations now, and you have chosen us to be your friend. but you have chosen a very poor friend. He was talking about the problems of the Chinese poverty. He was more or less hat in hand at that point. And at this point, of course, well, let's also note that Carter, that Clinton did the same thing. He was lecturing about human rights in this case. Bush was lecturing on currency manipulation, and they could do that now. Obama cannot lecture on anything, especially given the fact that for the last 20-some years, the United States has been lecturing China on its banking system and how it should be more stable. So given the response that China has had to the world economic downturn and financial crisis, it seems unlikely that, again, we will ever get a chance to lecture China.
Hmm. Let me ask you why China has been able to weather the financial crisis in pretty good form, and if there is something that the president was asking from them on this trip that would help us through our financial crisis?
Well, the major requests that he had were concerning strategic matters, such as help with North Korea and Afghanistan and so on. There was an economic element to it, in which the major question were basically were three. The major questions were three. First, allowing the yuan to appreciate, the renminbi, the Chinese currency, to appreciate. Secondly, more market openness. And then thirdly, the question of intellectual property. Now, these have been in the forefront for at least 10 years. There has been back and forth exchange on it, that occasionally you'd have an intellectual property case be settled. But for the most part, the Chinese have not changed their positions on anything, except that the most recent statement on the yuan has different wording from the previous statements, which might allow, which one expects is hinting at, the yuan to appreciate. So that's basically the thing that would also help us directly economically. But we're in a very interesting situation now. In the Cold War, we had, because of nuclear weapons, mutually assured destruction. Today, we have a similar situation, economic mutually assured destruction. The China is caught in the dollar trap. It cannot, even though it often makes noises to that effect, it cannot allow the dollar to fall, because they hold so much of it, they would be shooting themselves in the foot. They would lose even more. They can't get out of this dollar trap easily.
How much of the dollar do they hold now, Professor Alito?
Oh, well, 1.2 trillion.
Wow.
Treasury bills, yes.
Huh.
Which is considerable.
It sure is.
And so China is this creditor nation that, well, of course, it wouldn't dare attempt to influence your domestic policy in the U.S., but they are extremely interested in any domestic policy that's going to affect the deficit. That is because, after all, it's their money mm-hmm. that we're spending.
Mm-hmm. Nick from Madison is next. Hi, Nick.
Good morning. What a great conversation. We had two adopted children from China and have been there three times. And one of the things that we remarked on were the amazing changes just from 1997 to 1998. And then last year we went to visit. And some of the cities that had virtually no vehicles are now totally people get around by car. and we no longer had to watch out for getting run over by bicycles, but rather cars. just some of the changes. And one of the, I think the most frustrating thing that I experienced in China was that I always wanted to go to places that were original. Like I wanted to go to parts of the Great Wall that were original. And you're always taken to Bottling, which has been kind of like the Wisconsin Dells of the Great Wall. So, but great conversation, and I'll keep on listening.
How old are your children now, Nick?
13 and 11.
Huh.
Yeah, they're amazing kids. We just love it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the call, Nick. Let's go to Dan next from La Crosse. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi. I'm curious. Maybe my understanding's a little bit flawed, but I've read and heard that significant elements of Chinese culture are fairly racist or ethnocentric, and I'm just wondering how that might have. I know there are supposedly a lot of things said about our former Secretary of State, who was black, and I'm wondering how the response might be to a black president because of that.
Well. It depends upon what you mean by traditional. There was, in my opinion, no category of it could be considered race in traditional China. That is, you were human, fully human, because you observed the five relationships, and if you become learned, that makes you more moral, and therefore the early Jesuits, like Matteo Ricci and so on, they became famous scholars and were completely accepted, even though they looked kind of weird. So up until the time of the importation of certain Western ideas at the very end of the 19th century and early 20th century, you don't have race as a category. As to ethnocentrism, that indeed has been a feature of all the civilizations, including the ancient Mediterranean ones. It's also true of various tribes, Neolithic, and technologically Neolithic tribes that around the world that exist. But in the Chinese case, however, unlike, say, the ancient Babylonian case, the ancient Egyptian case, and the ancient Greek case, the Chinese were able to maintain the notion of a true civilization being also the way that Chinese did things for, you could say, 4,000 years. This makes Chinese ethnocentrism, if you want to call it that, somewhat special, in fact, unique. It is also notable that the concept of universal kingship that, again, ancient Middle Eastern cultures had was continuous, and one of those points of continuity in Chinese civilization for more or less four millennia as well. Now, in the 20th century, there have been the elements of, sort of race and racial prejudice introduced, but I'm not sure that, say, the president's race is regarded in the same way. And you have conflicts between Africans and Chinese in China. In fact, I have two undergraduates doing their BA theses on precisely this topic.
Hmm.
I can't say that in the case of Obama, it plays any role at all, except perhaps that it reflects well on the United States, because the line has been, all along that black people in the United States are utterly suppressed and exploited and so on. So I wouldn't say that that Obama's race is anything negative at all. It is, if anything, positive, because it gives lie to these originally the official line on race in the United States. Mm.
And that's true for many other countries in the world, right?
Yes.
That's very striking. How large an African population does China have?
Well, it's spotty. There are, of course, African students throughout the place. There's something called Chocolate Town, Chocolate Cheng. Basically, it's part of Canton, Guangzhou City, where you have 20,000 Africans living together in the same neighborhood. That's the only enclave of black people that I know of. The rest tend to be there for a particular purpose, students, businessmen, and so on, and they do not necessarily hang together.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls. We have lines open if you've been trying to join the conversation. We're talking about China this hour, and our guest is a fascinating guy. Professor Guy Alito is at the University of Chicago and served as the major official interpreter for the first official Chinese delegations visiting the United States in 1972 during Nixon's presidency. He teaches a lot of different things, primarily focusing on modern Chinese history at the University of Chicago. And we're welcoming phone calls on the president's trip. 800-486-8655 is our number, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. John from Milwaukee is next. Hi, John.
Well, Professor, the Jesuits probably looked weird to the Chinese because they wore black cassocks, their black robes, and their berettas back then. And that leads me to when we have a linguist on the show, it's always interesting to discuss concepts and words that one particular language has that another does not. In German, there's the concept of der Stammtisch. It means a table that's reserved for your regular customers or patrons in a bar or a restaurant. I use the word beretta that has a narrow concept of a hat worn by a priest during mass. Are there words in Chinese and concepts that you can cite that we can't translate and that are...
Oh, the list would be too long. That is, especially because Chinese, unlike, say, other Indo-European languages, has absolutely no cognates at all with, say, in this case, English. There's none, period. So, yes, the list would be enormous. And, in fact, sometimes subject to treatment in monographic form. They are indeed enormous. The Jesuits, however, did dress Chinese. They were regarded as looking strange because they had high noses and extremely heavy beards. In other words, you look at a portrait of Matteo Ricci, and he's wearing a Chinese-style hat, not a beretta.
So when you run into those, which you would run into rather frequently, those phrases that are just almost impossible to translate to English, what do you do about that?
Well, you have two choices. One, you make an approximation with some English equivalent that would be closest, and the other is to spend more words on it. Depending upon the situation, if you don't have that extra time, you have to settle for not entirely accurate. This has been true, though, forever, that you look at translations, written translations of Chinese work, and they are sometimes so literal as to be opaque. That is, you can translate something perfectly accurately in a certain sense into English from Chinese, and it just doesn't convey anything. I've noted that I'm forced to use such translations in, say, my larger undergraduate courses, and I've always been dissatisfied with them, precisely because of this. It's a big and a generally hidden problem, because the especially in traditional Chinese. I mean, modern Chinese didn't really exist, certainly as a written language, prior to the 1920s, and much of it was imported from Japan, because the Japanese had already rendered a lot of Western things into Chinese characters. And then more recently, a great bulk of, technical terms having to do with computers and so on are, again, direct and literal translations from usually English. And they don't make any sense in Chinese, but after they've been in use, they are an entity that now everyone knows what it refers to, and therefore the term can be freely used. I'm thinking of things like, well, driver, and you translate that directly into Chinese, and it doesn't it doesn't suggest anything.
Really?
Yeah, but because it's now in such common use, it's become as Chinese as any other term.
Right.
So in the technical business world, it's basically the terminology is directly from foreign languages. Because English, after all, you have to face it, is the first functioning world language in so many spheres. And in fact, you know that Chicago's city schools teach Chinese, and not all of them, but a good number of them. And our Mayor Richard Daley, has said in the future there are only going to be two languages in the world, one English and one Chinese.
Really? When will that be, Professor?
Well, no, it is true that the smaller languages are beginning to drop off existence. Dutch literature, for instance, is now no longer taught in the universities in the Netherlands. It's gone. So, especially with the internet, when you have instantaneous communication, a form of communication in which English is still the major instrument for, it's not unimaginable.
Right.
Just that there are more Chinese speakers than any other
Anything.
Language.
Yeah, we tend to forget that. It's a big place. Professor Guy Alito is our guest, associate professor in history and East Asian languages and civilizations at the University of Chicago. We're talking about China. He has a long history with modern China, being an interpreter for the first Chinese delegations coming to the United States back when President Nixon opened this country to China in 1972. He's done a lot of very important translation work for Chinese delegations. Our phone number, and we thank you very much, John, for your call. That was an interesting one. We have a couple lines open. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email address, talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The number of people in this country who are hungry, who have food, what's now called insecurity, has been going up significantly in the last couple of years. We will talk about that and how we keep people from being hungry in the United States, hour number two. Back to phone calls. Mike from Appleton is next. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Two questions for the professor. First, during the Cold War, I guess you could say between the Russians and the Americans, there was a similarity of roots, and so we could kind of gauge, and the Russians could gauge, how we were going to react to any given set of circumstances. However, as time progresses and as we probably get into a Cold War-type situation with China, as tensions increase because of lack of resources, et cetera, we're talking about two completely different backgrounds, roots, you know, whatever you want to call it. You know, what implications does that have? That's the first question. And the second question is, the Chinese take a very long-term view of things in general. What are your feelings as to what their long-term view of their position in the world is, you know, versus the United States?
Well, those are two very interesting questions, Mike. I do not think, I will have to say, there is going to be a Cold War-like situation developing with China, precisely because we are, our fates are locked together. That is, it is in the interests of China to have the U.S. economy do well because it owns so much of it. It is the interests of the United States, you know, for you know, China to continue to develop. There cannot be a mutually antagonistic relationship because each side would end up shooting themselves in the foot at this point. So that's why I don't think there could be a Cold War-like situation developing. Competition for resources is, of course, occurring right now. And that doesn't mean, however, that China and the United States are going to go head to head about it. There are a lot of other economies in the world that are also in on that competition. It does not necessarily mean that it is the U.S. and China specifically that are going to be locked in a struggle over them. The second question about Chinese taking a long-term view in general, what do Chinese think their future or would be in the long term? This is indeed an extremely interesting question. If you look at, say, all of human history, human existence, since 200 BC or so, the former Han Dynasty, a long-term dynasty, you'd have to conclude, if you're an ET going around the world at a particular time, you'd have to conclude that it was East Asia that was the developed world for most of human history. With China in the center. And that is across the board, surprisingly. Levels of technology, levels of standards of living, and even levels of literacy were generally higher. There is a certain dip that takes place during the Yuan or Mongol dynasty. That's when Marco Polo went there. And nevertheless, this is up until maybe the middle of the 18th century. This is still was still the case. To a certain extent, Chinese see themselves as achieving great power status, certainly being the dominant power in East Asia and a major player on the world stage, equal to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Mike, for your interesting questions. Paul from Green Bay is next. Hi, Paul.
Thank you for this wonderful conversation. I would like to ask the professor if he could discuss the implications of the one-child policy.
Oh, well, the implications have been discussed considerably in the press. It is presently being altered. There are certain exceptions now being made in addition to the national minorities, who are always exceptions. The implications are that the generation of Chinese, actually the present generation coming of age, will not only will they have no brothers and sisters, they will have no they will be spoiled. They will have expectations beyond reality, because given the Chinese devotion to
the
progeny and the importance that was always attached to it, there are very few progeny now. So the interests of grandparents and parents and other relatives are now centered on the child, which indeed has a tendency to make the child somewhat spoiled. And I think that to a certain extent, this is perhaps a bold statement, but you can see such tendencies in the young generation in China today. They often dismiss stories by their elders about how bad it was before, because they've known nothing but for the last 30 years, where things have been quite good indeed. Perhaps my generation, hearing our parents talk about the Great Depression in the United States, we were perhaps a little bit that way. To tell a young person that once upon a time there were people hungry in great numbers in China, or starved to death in great numbers, as they did 59-61, they would tend to dismiss it as attempts to somehow influence them and to keep them in line or something of that sort. That's the first and major implication.
Mm. And then you have the parents and grandparents in some cases now, although their children would be young, who lived through the Cultural Revolution that really turned that country upside down and affected so many lives. That must be, as you say, for a spoiled generation, pretty hard to imagine.
Oh, indeed. Indeed it is. And there's another factor here. I spent a good deal of time living in the countryside interviewing old people for local history. And I found that people generally do not want to discuss it. It's too painful. They do not often tell their children about it because it's too painful. They don't want to bring it up. And there is, now that China is on the rise, there is a kind of distorted patriotism these days that will tend to defend some of the actions of the Cultural Revolution. Mm. It's, of course, true that the state wants to shove it all under the rug. To do research in the Cultural Revolution is essentially something you're not supposed to do, period.
Mm-hmm.
And you might recall there was some of my own students doing research in China on that were detained.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. And there was that Dickinson College librarian, a Chinese man who was, essentially he was detained for a good long time, like months.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was collecting materials on the Cultural Revolution.
Mm.
So in the end, I think that that entire experience, not the entire experience, of course, is going to be lost forever. There are a few people, one of my colleagues here, Wang Youqin Wang, has done a lot of work in collecting of oral histories of people during the Cultural Revolution in the educational realm. And she was able to, among other things, determine exactly how many people did die in Beijing University during such and such a period. These things are, the official figures are totally unreliable. Hmm. Now, her website has always been blocked. She can't publish anything within China. She can only publish in Hong Kong.
Huh.
And this would be a typical expression of the state's attitude toward what we do.
Yeah, it's always an undercurrent of what's going on. We're out of time. Professor Alito, thank you so much. It was just a fascinating hour. Thank you.
Well, yes, indeed. It was my pleasure, Kathleen.
Professor Guy Alito, he is at the University of Chicago and has been doing translating work in addition to writing books with Chinese delegations going way back to 1972 when the door was opened to China. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production as well. We have news coming up, and we'll return with more conversation on the Ideas Network.